You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
Hello. Thank you for joining us for this podcast entitled EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors for the treatment of metastatic non-small cell lung cancer harboring uncommon EGFR mutation. My name is Xunning Li. I'm an assistant professor from UT MD Anderson Cancer Center. Today, we have three other experts in the field for this discussion. Dr. Daniel Costa, can you please introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Daniel Costa. I'm a thoracic medical oncologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. I am the group leader for our thoracic oncology program and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
Dr. Eric Nadler, can you please introduce yourself?
My name is Eric Nadler. I'm a head and neck and thoracic oncologist at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas, and I run health informatics for thoracic and head and neck cancers in the U.S. Oncology Network, so I have a huge database of information in which to call from.
All right. Dr. John Haymack, can you please introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm John Haymack. I'm a thoracic medical oncologist, and I'm chair of the Department of Thoracic and Head and Neck Medical Oncology at MD Anderson Cancer Center.
All right. For today, first of all, I want to ask Dan to provide some background information on what we really mean by saying uncommon EGFR mutation, and what's their uncommon EGFR mutation's role in lung cancer?
Thank you, Janine, for that question. I think that it's very important to understand the prevalence of different EGFR mutations. As we know now, EGFR mutations are present in around 15% of all lung adenocarcinomas diagnosed in the United States. The prevalence changes depending on worldwide characteristics, with higher frequency seen in East Asian countries. But amongst the various types of EGFR mutations, the predominant changes occur in the kinase domain. The most frequent mutations are within the exon 19, small deletions or small insertion deletions indels. They account for around 45% or so of all EGFR mutations, followed by a common exon 21 point mutation called L858R that accounts for another 35% of all EGFR mutations. So these two classes of mutants are the most common EGFR mutations and usually called classical EGFR mutations. The third most common type of EGFR mutation include small insertions within exon 20 of EGFR. They account for around 5 to 10% of all EGFR mutations. These three main classes are where most of clinical trial development and drug approvals have occurred. For the classical EGFR exon 19 deletions and L858R mutations, there are many classes of first, second, and third generation EGFR inhibitors approved, all of them with high-level randomized clinical trial data to support their use in clinical practice. These EGFR inhibitors have supplanted the use of traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy for the first-line care of patients with metastatic disease, and some of them have entered our use in the more early-stage disease, including the adjuvant setting. The current preferred EGFR inhibitor for these mutations worldwide is the third-generation EGFR inhibitor osimertinib, that has the best adverse event profile, the highest central nervous system activity, and best clinical outcomes as it relates for both progression-free and overall survival, both in the metastatic and in the adjuvant setting. For the EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, the two approved drugs are different than the ones approved for the classical mutations. For EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, the FDA over the last 2 years approved the EGFR inhibitor mobocertinib and the monoclonal antibody amivantamab due to the activity that is seen in these group of patients who harbor these mutations that in preclinical models are not as sensitive to first, second, and third generation EGFR inhibitors. Now, after these three classes of mutations, we come up with another group of around 10% of more of kinase domain mutations that are grouped together and called less common, uncommon, or atypical EGFR mutations. Amongst this group, the most frequent is the EGFR G719X series of mutations. The X usually either G719A, G719C, or G719S. They account for around 3 to 6% of all kinase domain mutations. The next most common amongst these uncommon mutations is the exon 21 L861Q mutation, accounting for 2 to 3% of all kinase domain mutations. And then the exon 20 X768I point mutation that account for approximately 1% of all kinase domain mutations. All these mutations, as we'll discuss in this podcast, have their particular preclinical response rates to EGFR inhibitors and some clinical approvals that match that pattern, as we will be discussing, including both for approved drugs and guideline-approved therapies.
Thank you, Dan. So, like you pointed out, I think there currently there is a lack of robust clinical data set for those uncommon mutations. Now, the question is, can we use preclinical models and the findings to help to support a treatment decision? John, can you please comment on that?
Well, thanks, Shanine. In preclinical studies, we've looked at more than 100 different mutations and combinations, and the data clearly tells us that sensitivity to different tyrosine kinase inhibitors varies between different EGFR mutation subtypes. So, given all these different mutations, we can't do separate studies for each mutation. So, the question is how to best classify or group them. It's been grouped or classified by a couple different methods in the past. One is based on the frequency, just common or uncommon. A second is to classify mutations based on the location, like exon 18, exon 19, exon 20 mutations. But neither one of these is a great predictor of the sensitivity. The key issue is how a mutation impacts the three-dimensional structure of the EGFR protein and how it interacts with the tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So it's now possible to categorize the mutations based on this structural impact on the EGFR protein, and it turns out that this is a much better predictor of their sensitivity to tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Recently, we defined four different categories. The first one are classical-like mutations, and these have sensitivities like the classical mutations. One classical-like mutant is the L861Q, and these tend to be sensitive to broadly to all different EGFR TKIs. The second group of mutations occur on the interior surface of this ATP binding pocket, and they're predicted to squeeze together that binding pocket and make it a bit smaller. We call these PACC mutations. This stands for P-loop and alpha C-helix compressing. And this group includes mutations in different exons. Common ones include the G719X mutations and the S768I mutations. And it turns out these are most sensitive to second-generation TKIs like afatinib, but are less sensitive to first or third-generation inhibitors. And the third class are insertions in the loop at the C-terminal end of the alpha C-helix of exon 20. So we call those exon 20 loop insertions. And we actually can even divide the loop insertions into two groups, the far loop and the near loop insertions. The far loop insertions are generally resistant to more TKIs, but they may be sensitive to a new class of EGFR exon 20 inhibitors that are more mutant selective. Whereas the near loop mutations may be more sensitive to second generation TKIs and exon 20 insertion specific TKIs like mobocertinib as well as amivantamab, but they're not sensitive to first generation TKIs like erlotinib and gefitinib or to third generation drugs like osimertinib. And then finally, the final category are T790M-like mutations. These occur in the hydrophobic core of the EGFR protein, and we have two different subgroups of these according to their sensitivity to the third-generation EGFR TKIs. We call them T790M-like third-generation sensitive and T790M-like third-generation resistant. To put this all together, and I know I just covered a lot of different information there, but the key take home is that there's an increasing body of preclinical data that lets us better select which TKI for an uncommon mutation based on the structural subgroup of EGFR. But this does require more robust clinical data to confirm these preclinical observations.
Thank you, John. Thinking about clinical data, in 2021, NCCN guideline had an update that they included afatinib and osimertinib as preferred first-line treatment option for patients with metastatic lung cancer, specifically harboring the G719X, means any amino acids, L861Q or S768I mutation. Then, can you comment on what are the clinical evidence behind this NCCN guideline?
Sure. I think that it's important to note, as John just highlighted, the incredible translation of the findings from the laboratory in these preclinical models with what we see in the clinic. So, I think, as John highlighted, some of the EGFR mutation subtypes that we are discussing, in specific, the G719X type mutations, the L861Q mutation, and the S768I mutation, they are EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor sensitive mutations. They do have a pattern of response that is slightly different depending on the mutation than the common mutations, but there is evolving clinical data to support the use of FDA either approved inhibitors for that mutation type or for other mutations. So, as an example, for these three classes of EGFR uncommon mutations, there was a 2018 approval for the second generation EGFR inhibitor afatinib at its 40 milligram daily dose. And this was based on a post hoc analysis of the registrations Lung 2, 3, and 6 trials of afatinib. In that particular analysis, 38 patients with these mutations were able to be analyzed, and it was observed that the overall response rate at around 71%, the progression-free survival at around 10.7 months, and the overall survival at around 19.4 months were quite similar to that observed with the more common mutations. And that led to the clinical approval of that drug for these three separate less common EGFR mutations. But it's been pretty clear as we have evolved data not only from the FDA approval, but other larger cohorts, including large retrospective databases of use of afatinib, that there is some heterogeneity on which type of tumors with each mutation respond best or not to afatinib. So, I think, as John mentioned eloquently in his preclinical work, this group of mutations called PACC, which incorporate the G719X mutation and the S768I, are the ones that have the most sensitivity preclinically to second generation inhibitors like afatinib. But in the clinic, those tumors are the ones also that have the highest response rates and the longest durations of response. And both the post hoc analysis of the prospective Lux trials and these large retrospective databases, plus other large multicenter studies have confirmed this. So I think for the data for afatinib, it's pretty clear that it's a pan EGFR mutation active inhibitor, but for the G719X and the S768I mutations, it looks particularly clinically active, and it's where we see the highest response rates and the longest durations of response.
So thank you, Dan, for summarizing the data. But really, to me, I hope you agree as well, those clinical data, although they're not large randomized study, but they're really consistent with our preclinical work from Dr. John Heymach's lab, showing that the PACC mutation, especially the two that you just talked about, they respond best to the second generation EGFR TKI. Will you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I think that we all know that second generation EGFR inhibitors have a distinct pattern of adverse events with high level of both skin and gastrointestinal toxicities that are related to the levels of inhibition of the wild type EGFR. But in the two mutations that you mentioned and that correlate with the preclinical work, the EGFR G719X and the EGFR 768I, the clinical responses, even when those reductions are necessary, seem to be the most robust, really highlighting the preclinical work showing that these mutants are because of their structure function properties are most sensitive to this type of EGFR TKI inhibition.
Dan, can you go back to the retrospective analysis you just commented or mentioned? Some of them are actually pretty large scale and also included beyond the second generation EGFR TKI, including first gen and the third gen. Can you comment on what those research have shown, and then is it consistent with preclinical? If you can give us some insight for first gen and the third gen.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think I can respond to that talking specifically by mutation type. So again, the other high-level correlation with preclinical data is for the L861Q mutated tumor. So as John mentioned, L861Q in this novel structure TKI response model is binned within the classical mutations, more akin to exon 19 deletions and L858R. And I think that the large retrospective database and the few prospective trials of third-generation inhibitor osimertinib for these less common mutations have shown this, that for L861Q, you see the highest response rates with drugs like osimertinib and the longest periods and durations of response. So as an example, there was a phase two clinical study of osimertinib for these less common mutations run out of Korea. And in the 36 patients that they identified for this particular study, they observed overall response rate of around 50%, but in the for all these less common mutations. But when you look at the data for the L861Q, they had response rates that were much higher, more in concert with what you see with the exon 19 deletions and L858R, while the G719X mutant group, which was the second most prevalent in this particular study, had response rates that were slightly lower, and the durations of response also. So I think for the third generation inhibitors, this small prospective study combined with some ongoing larger data sets that have come out, including one that has a name called Unicorn that has evaluated in large data sets around the world the effects of osimertinib in less common EGFR mutants. It has confirmed this observation that L861Q mutated EGFR mutated tumors tend to respond quite well to osimertinib, matching the preclinical data that this is a classical-like mutation. While these cohorts have consistently shown that for drugs like osimertinib, the third generation inhibitor, although there are responses with the G719X and S768I, they tend to be with overall response rates that are either at 50% or below. and the durations of response seem somewhat shorter. And now, Janine, the last part of your question about the use of first-generation EGFR inhibitors like gefitinib and erlotinib. Although there is slight preclinical activity in these three most common uncommon mutations, the S768I, L861Q, and G719X, the clinical data has shown that the degree and duration of response is modest. Hence why many compendium guidelines, including NCCN, have not included routine use of these drugs in their recommendations. Although one must say that for a particular healthcare system that does not have an access to a drug like afatinib or osimertinib, there is some clinical activity for these three mutants with the first-generation EGFR inhibitors.
Thank you. Now we have talked about the current NCCN guideline for treating those uncommon EGFR mutation, and then we talk about the evidence behind the NCCN guideline. Eric, can you please comment on in day-to-day, in the real-life practice, from the oncologist perspective, do you think those guidelines are followed? And then do you think a patient really derive benefit from those guideline recommendations?
It's a complicated question, and if we went back about 3 or 4 years, the data that we have emerging has changed and is in flux during that time. Roughly in 2019 and 2020, the testing patterns of the United States, particularly in the community, roughly 70 or 80% of people would test for one mutation. But multiplex testing or more than one mutation were tested only 45 to 50% of the time. And at that time, in emerging next generation sequencing was in the teens, 15, 16%, even as we crested over through 2020. If you look over the year or two after that, kind of at the beginnings of COVID, those numbers have changed markedly, but they're still not probably where we'd want them. First and foremost, single genetic testing panels in the metastatic setting really don't exist anymore. So most patients are being tested for more than one thing at a time, and that's been true for at least 3 years now. And if you look at the next generation sequencing adoption throughout the nation, it went from about 30% in 2020, in mid-2020, to now more than 90% of all testing is next generation sequencing. Now, lots of challenges with next generation sequencing because that could be both plasma and tissue, and sometimes both. And of course, with any in our national consortium of practicing oncologists, there's a lot of heterogeneity in how people test and what people test and which tests they use, whether or not it's both RNA and DNA containing or whether it's just tissue or plasma. That being said, it's certainly moving in the right direction. But a couple of big points here that I think we should mention. The first is are we testing all the non-squams or are squams actually being tested? And we know we can see EGFR and KRAS and other mutations in the squams, and certainly that's happening more and more. The second thing is turnaround time has pushed a lot of people toward testing plasma-based approaches initially, sometimes in lieu of tissue-based testing, just because of the ease of it and the turnaround time of some of the plasma-based approaches, and whether that be Guardant or Cobra, they tend to be quicker than our tissue-based counterparts. And lastly, there's a lot of geographic heterogeneity in our testing. I work in Texas in a large community practice, and almost all of our patients are being tested in non-small cell lung cancer in the advanced setting. But you go to the state to the left or the right of me, and those rates could fall to 70% even today. So it's a challenging, complicated time, and really things like this podcast really I hope will help inform and educate that at least tissue-based testing and when that's difficult for turnaround time and tissue, you could add plasma to that easily, should be done in all patients with non-small cell lung cancer. And like I said, over the past 3 years, our numbers have more than doubled, but they're still not where any of us would consider optimal.
Eric, may I ask a follow-up question? So for physicians, when they see a report with a EGFR G719S, for example, how often the clinical oncologist can really pick the recommended afatinib upfront, or you think there is still a need to educate our even peer so that they can, even based on current guideline, to match the appropriate genotype to the right drug?
Basically, if you look at the testing patterns of the last 18 months of the United States, we're certainly moving more toward an optimal direction in which the majority of our patients now nationally are being tested with next generation sequencing. And furthermore, we're moving more and more toward a more comprehensive testing pattern of thoracic malignancies in which not just the non-small cell, non-squamous patients are being tested, but also an emerging and larger percentage of the squamous patients are being tested. And we're seeing that in our community databases as well, both of which I think is a giant step forward.
Thank you, Eric. Although afatinib now is approved for non-resistant mutations, other than uncommon mutations are still lacking a approved TKI. So there is a clear unmet need for the mutations we actually know that exist in the PEG, for example, and other classes, but not the three that we mentioned. We don't have a real approved TKI. John, can you please comment on how do you envision this field of uncommon EGFR mutation will evolve going forward?
It's straightforward preclinically to match different mutations with the best drug because we can do those studies in the laboratory, and they're relatively straightforward. The greater challenge is how do we test this in the clinic, given the enormous number of mutations that are out there. As I mentioned, we've seen more than 100 different mutations or combination mutations, compound mutations that may have two or three mutations combined together. So how do we implement this clinically and verify that what we find in the lab matches what happens in the clinic? Well, this is where the classification system I described before can be helpful, because we can't do separate clinical trials for every mutation, but we can do clinical trials that encompass a whole group of mutations, like PACC mutations or classical-like mutations, and test drugs for that specific subgroup. So I think that's really going to be an important step forward now, which will let us start testing mutations much more broadly than just classical mutations or the three next most common mutations, the G719X, the S768I, and the L861Q. I think having a classification in place will really let us start testing for any mutation that comes along, as long as we know which group it belongs to. And so, I think this is really the greatest unmet need, these rare atypical mutations. So moving beyond these three mutations, the G719X, the S768I, and the L861Q, these other uncommon mutations are much more heterogeneous, and this is where the classification can be helpful for enabling patients with any of these mutations to go on studies. Developing a larger clinical data set for these rare atypical mutations then is really the most important next step. And the larger this database grows and the more practical it is to do these clinical studies, the more we'll learn about how to treat these rare atypical mutations. Now, we do have some data with some other rare mutations. For example, L747X and E709X have demonstrated some clinical sensitivity to afatinib based on clinical databases and case studies that we have. And both of those would be classified as PACC mutations. So that's consistent with the data I mentioned before that PACC mutants seem to be more sensitive to afatinib. In case reports, osimertinib, again a third-generation drug, has demonstrated variable activity against L747P, with some studies saying that that mutation is resistant to osimertinib, others saying that there is some sensitivity. So I think we need larger data really to see how that settles out. Now, one other challenge that's worth mentioning is tumors sometimes have more than one mutation that are occurring in the same gene. We call these compound mutations. As an example, and this was actually early work from Dan Costa that I think really highlighted some of this, tumors will often have a mutation in, for example, the G719 and a 709 mutation or a 758 mutation at the same time. So there are pairs of mutations that commonly occur together. And there isn't an easy way to predict what the sensitivity is going to be other than to test those directly. So there, I think we're going to need to just have a large retrospective database to get clues, use the preclinical modeling, and then test them prospectively in the same type of clinical trials that we mentioned before. You know, in some recent meta-analyses, outcomes in patients who had EGFR inhibitors were generally better among patients with compound mutations if they had a classical mutation, like a deletion 19 or an L858R, with a second mutation, as compared to when there were two rare independent compound mutations. So if you've got a classical mutation as part of the compound mutation, it's more likely to be sensitive, is what the data is suggesting. And there's data supporting that those compound mutations, if they have a classical mutation as part of that, are often sensitive to erlotinib, gefitinib, so first-generation drugs, or afatinib. But if they've got two uncommon mutations, afatinib seems to perform better. There's also some data saying that osimertinib is effective against certain compound mutations. In one study, and it was just with four patients, there was a response rate of 75% among those four patients to osimertinib if they had a compound mutation that did not include deletion 19 or L858R. And in the recent UNICORN study, there was an encouraging response rate in PFS in patients with some uncommon mutations. So patients who had an uncommon mutation plus an L858R or exon 19 deletion or T790M, the response rate was 61%, and the median PFS was 30 months. And in a much larger retrospective database with over 8,000 patients with NGS data for among patients who received osimertinib, there were eight patients who received who had a T854A mutation plus an L858R classical mutation. And there the response rate was 80%, and median PFS was 10 months. So, you know, in summary, the real-world data can help support treatment decisions for some mutations, but we just don't have enough data from enough different mutations to make firm decisions for every mutation that comes along. This is really a major unmet need, is to develop more data with more different drugs so that we can best start matching drugs with mutations.
From today's conversation, we've heard many different EGFR mutations, some at the mutational level. Sometimes we use different words to refer as uncommon, atypical. So then let me ask you, is it a problem that we have so many different calling and the different nomenclatures around the mutation? Is it a barrier for physicians to know how to offer the best treatment for a specific EGFR mutation to a patient?
Yes, I think that this is a major, major issue that needs to be addressed. I think that the lack of standardization on how to both classify the diversity of EGFR mutations and how to ask our partners in the diagnostic setting to use any classification that we use creates a lot of potential places where there could be both gaps in knowledge and also gaps in implementation of the evolving knowledge that we have been discussing here, from preclinical models to both prospective real-world retrospective data sets. The information is not always easily accessible to a practicing provider. I think, as Eric pointed out, although there has been an uptake in use of more comprehensive genetic profiling, including next-generation sequencing that can capture the breadth and diversity of both single or compound EGFR mutations, not always is the explanation of a identifiable mutation easy for a provider to understand and to link to both FDA approval of particular EGFR inhibitors and also NCCN or other large guidelines that exist. And obviously, I think for physicians that are specialized in EGFR mutated lung cancer, similar to myself, John, and a few academic oncologists that do this on a day-to-day basis, like yourself, Shunin, obviously we can keep up with the evolving use of different terminologies, and we can adapt much easier with the ideas of using a mutation-rich structure-based classification where we are almost just focusing on a particular mutation and then understanding all the work that has gone on from preclinical models to all clinical studies. But I think that this doesn't translate very well for a community practicing oncologist. And obviously, it will be important to get Eric's perspective, what he hears from colleagues and others. But I do believe that one clear unmet need is to have better reporting where all this knowledge that we've gathered since the discovery of EGFR mutations in 2003, 2004 to now is put together so that the clinician can read, understand in simple terms what that particular mutation means from sensitivity to inhibitors, give them a list of the FDA-approved inhibitors and why they were approved, and also other options like NCCN guidelines where they can use off-label and then match with the clinical scenario. Like if they see a patient with brain metastasis and then they have the ability to select between drug X or Y based on both efficacy, clinical parameters, toxicity expectations, and others. So I think that this is a major need that we need to address.
Yeah, Eric, can you also comment? I think you probably work with more diagnostic platforms as well. Can you also comment on what's your perspective of this challenging with so many mutations and so many different nomenclatures?
Well, I completely agree with Dan, and he stated it beautifully. But the challenge is when you're working outside of a large academic institution where really they have a strong preferential internal testing platform, in the community or in smaller academic centers, you're talking about potentially two or three different platforms that are being used by every practitioner, sometimes more. In my institution, the hospital uses one, and I routinely use another one. And then when I see patients in second and third opinions, I'm seeing different tests. And the challenge is each one of these testing companies reports this information in their own unique and distinct way with no homogenization of how they classify the mutation itself, whether it be typical or atypical. How they describe the mutation, whether it be the full mutation out to seven or eight digits or kind of lump and group it into a more simplified form. There are few, if any, recommendations in terms of treatment in any of these reports that really direct you in terms of recommended treatments. And equally importantly, and I'll just mention, it doesn't direct you toward a clinical trial if one's available in your community or neck of the woods, which I think would be very helpful as well. So one would hope that over the next 12 to 24 months that the testing communities themselves both simplify the reports, make it more streamlined and homogeneous so that we have a repeatable and understandable form that this information is communicated to us. And lastly, that this is coupled with both NCCN or ISLAC or other types of guidelines that are given to the practitioner, as well as clinical studies that they could look for that are within 100 or 200 miles of them. And I think all of these things would be important, and they're all underway, so I'm not saying anything that isn't currently being discussed and happening, but I think that's very important that this really gets codified in a rigid way that you can look at a report, know what you're looking at, and know how to take that report and make actionable decisions based on it.
To summarize today's discussion, an update to NCCN guidelines report regarding G719X, L861Q, S768I is supported by a growing body of clinical evidence. A new characterization system allowing prediction of sensitivity to TKI for infrequent, often we name them uncommon EGFR mutations, are existing now that we can classify them into different four different classes based on the structural functions evidence supported preclinically. Real-world data and the mutation database are improving with clinical evidence for EGFR TKI selection against different uncommon EGFR mutations. However, clinical trial or prospective data are still lacking. Therefore, that's an unmet need for us to conduct clinical trials to improve what we currently have. Last, broader uptake of NGS for tumor molecular profiling and the variability of better guidance for physicians are key obstacles to address going forward so that we can offer precision oncology to our lung cancer patients. I thank you for your attention, and I also want to thank Dr. Daniel Costa, Dr. Eric Nadler, and Dr. John Haymack for joining us today.
You are listening to an AIDS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to AIDS podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.